Welcome to Global Minnesota Podcasts, connecting, informing, and engaging Minnesotans with the world and exploring important international issues. For a complete list of programs and to join us, visit globalminnesota.org.
Good morning to everyone. Thank you for being part of this great decisions conversation. One of the things that's been remarkable for me is I came back to this area where I grew up after 35, 40 years abroad and in Washington working on foreign affairs issues, is the deep extent of commitment and engagement in this area on issues of international relations. It's terrific. You all represent it. Please keep it up and take part in Great Decisions programs as they present themselves. As Carol suggested, we thought it might be useful to broaden the conversation a little bit. Most of what you have heard is focused on Europe internally, so to speak, and some of the internal contradictions, internal developments, internal concerns, internal to the European Union. And we wanted to broaden that a little bit. European Union obviously exists in a broader world, and it especially exists in some kind of relationship with its immediate neighbors. And I somewhat mischievously chose for the target Europe's near abroad. That expression, near abroad, is usually used by Russians and by observers of Russia to talk about the former Soviet space. I don't want to talk about former European states, because that's sort of the wrong way of looking at it. But the immediate environs around Europe that affect trends in Europe, and that therefore also affect transatlantic interests and matters in which the United States has a set of concerns. And I think broadly the piece that I want to convey is that the turmoil, the uncertainty, the division, the fracturing that's taking place in Europe that you've already heard about, coupled together with negative, risky, disruptive trends on Europe's periphery combined, I think, to pose some particular challenges for European leaders going ahead and therefore for American interests. And it seems to me that that Europe's tools for influencing its region, protecting its interests vis-a-vis its immediate neighbors, providing security from problems that emanate from the big countries around it, all going down and pose a big set of worries. For me, the backdrop that I think is useful is how Europe talked about and saw itself and its ambitions just 10 or 15 years ago. And to some extent, this also concerns NATO, the mantra of expansion, all the rage as the European Union embarked on its largest and most ambitious enlargement ever, as was referred to earlier in 2004 and 5. And in a context coming out of the Cold War in which Europe saw itself not just protecting its immediate interests, but kind of advancing and building a new world order. New members in 2004 included Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, Hungary, Slovenia, the three Baltic states, and Little Cyprus and Malta. Not far behind in 2007, Bulgaria and Romania, Croatia in 2013, and oh, by the way, and we'll come back to this in 2004, European Union leaders also decided to open accession negotiations with Turkey, which began the following year, shortly before I arrived at the end of 2005. This idea, expansion all the rage, came to me when I was doing some research for this and found a very upbeat January 2007 BBC piece on EU enlargement. Its words reminded me of the catechism that was of European leaders, of European diplomats, and of the United States, and I supported this as well, that Europe EU expansion was an important means to unite a continent divided for decades by Cold War, to spread stability and security that goes with this big project, to foster prosperity and growth in a large, open, single economic market, to give Europe more clout as an actor on the world stage. And all those pieces went together, and they also went together with the idea that this new, larger Europe was part of a bulwark against possible future Russian expansion. The end of the Cold War, the defeat, or the failure, anyway, of the Soviet Union had been a windfall for Western societies, the breakup of this great empire, a whole bunch of little countries. Leaders in the United States, leaders in Europe, wanted them to stay that way, broken up, made it points of national policy to support their independence, their sovereignty, and territorial integrity. European Union leaders were methodical and vigorous in pursuing arrangements to draw closer with those countries, including the ones that came in the 2000s. As well as with other neighboring countries over the horizon, just a little bit beyond where the EU was likely to enlarge, but where Europe's interests demanded heightened engagement. Your EU sought to expand aid and other programs to support democratic values and institutions, market-oriented economic development. These included association agreements that seemed to offer a special political relationship of some sort, or at least engagement, and often some measure of free trade. Russia was part of that. There is an EU partnership and cooperation with agreement with Russia, but also agreements or efforts anyway by the EU with the other states that sort of reasonably qualify as, if not in Europe, at least on its periphery, Ukraine, Moldova, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan, and Ukraine, the famous case where agreements on EU association and the term was deep and comprehensive free trade, collided with Vladimir Putin's idea of a Eurasian economic union to spark the Orange Revolution that brought down the government, the pro-Russian government in Kyiv. After a political detour, those Ukraine-EU agreements kind of get back on track in 2016 and 17. And when that happened, and this sort of echoes what I talked about earlier, the expansion all the rage idea, or at least the idea that Europe was on the forefront of a big project in its neighborhood, came to me in the words that European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker declared when these EU-Ukraine agreements got done. He said, "Ukraine's place is in Europe, and its future lies in Europe." He was in part talking about Europe. He was in part talking about not Russia. And to me now, those words and the sentiment behind them, in light of the kind of things we were talking about earlier today, they seem kind of quaint if not more or less overtaken by events. That was the aspiration. In some respects, of course, it still is. Russia's engagement with Europe remains important to European Union leaders, but it's now highly problematic in a way that it wasn't 10, 15, 20 years ago. If European leaders found themselves not too discomforted by Moscow's takeover of bits of Georgia in 2008, the taking of Crimea from Ukraine in 2014, and the sponsorship of an insurrection in eastern Ukraine that continues to this day, that's a little bit more problematic, and add to that the challenges in Russia to democratic values, to human rights, the demise of even the pretense in Russia, which I think was there in the 1990s, the pretense that Russia saw itself as a European country in anything like the same way the Europeans saw themselves as European, that pretense gone away. But now we have a situation where Europe is focused internally. They're focused on these problems of nationalism, separatism, fragmentation, breakup in the case of the UK, as was discussed earlier, sickly economies, dubious economic prospects for the future. Those developments influence Europe's ability to have that Eastern agenda. It's a thing of the past. And as seen in Moscow, they hardly make Europe look decisive or committed on Eastern issues or on relations with Europe, or maybe generally in world politics. Its capacities seem much less. Europe's capacities seem much less. And add, sticking with this European, Eastern dimension, one thing that the Trump administration's rhetoric suggests is, as referred to earlier, Washington no longer sees the transatlantic alliance as the key focal point of U.S. foreign and defense policy. And to me, the sort of ballast that the United States has provided over the years, I mean, it's not quite the most apt word, but that's one I could come up with, the ballast that we represented in Europe's complicated relationship with the Soviet Union and with Russia today, that ballast isn't really there anymore. And it creates a lot, I think, creates a lot of uncertainty of quite great risk to our interests. How will Europe deal with further encroachment from Russia? Military action against a NATO member may still invoke Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty, but what about serious Russian moves deeper into Ukraine or Georgia or elsewhere in the Caucasus? What about provocations against non-NATO EU members like Finland or Sweden? What about intimidation, real intimidation, not just symbols, which is largely symbols in the Baltics, but what about something deeper and more meaningful? As equivocation in Europe and in the United States over Russian meddling in our democratic process suggests, the answers to these questions aren't as black and white as they as would have been expressed at a similar conference like this 10, 15, 20 years ago, to say nothing of 30 or 40, 50 years ago. Turkey poses some similar, although in some respects different, issues. Turkey was an early association agreement partner of the EU, entered into a customs union, not just free trade, but a full-blown customs union with the European Union in the 1990s that proved to be a powerful engine of Turkish economic growth and development and part of a political pull of Turkey toward Europe that then led to agreements to open accession negotiations. And at least in the way that European leaders talked about it at the time, and European diplomats certainly in Turkey, EU membership-oriented political and economic reforms would make Turkey a freer, more stable, more prosperous place. Accession would bring into the Union a large, dynamic market, a young, well-educated workforce, a source of growth for all of the rest of Europe, to bolster, a way to bolster Europe's security on the front lines of a lot of turbulence in the Middle East. During much of my time in Turkey as American ambassador, EU diplomats had an unusual amount of clout. This is 2005 to 2008, sort of the heyday of Turkey's accession negotiations. The situation I faced, American ambassadors in Turkey and a lot of other countries prodding on this or that issue quite frequently get heard as peremptory demands of a grumpy old uncle, if not maybe a bully. EU advocacy reform, because it was tied to things that Turkey had to do to even have a serious conversation about becoming a member of the club, a whole different conversation, and one that even proud, sometimes a little bit arrogant, Turkish leaders had to and did listen to and engage in. Several things, of course, went wrong. In 2006, only a year after opening accession talks, the EU froze big chunks of the agenda, took various chapters, negotiating chapters, off the table, forced into doing so by Cyprus and by countries that were skeptical about Turkey getting into the European Union, who found it easy and convenient to hide behind the Cypriots to do so. Over the next several years, more and more chapters got taken off of the table, so that by 2012 or 13, before the real authoritarian turn starts in Turkey, the EU effort was on life support. It was no longer an engine or a factor encouraging reform in Turkey. And Turkey's interest in the whole thing waned. And I say that it's not Europe's fault that Turkey has fallen off the democratic wagon to the extent that it was on it. But nevertheless, Europe gave up a powerful instrument to affect developments in Turkey that it had through this process, and the result has been very negative. Turkey, of course, did its bit, and I mean, obviously that's important. EU bashing by Erdogan, games playing over refugees, games playing in trying to secure votes in the most obnoxious ways for Erdogan's Justice and Development Party among Turkish nationals living in Europe. And then, of course, there's the coup. And what Turks universally regard, whether they're pro-Erdogan or not pro-Erdogan, universally regard as Europe's indifference at the overthrow of a democratically elected government. The coup, and especially the awful purges that have come after it, leave Turkey less capable on the international scene than in a generation, less reliable as a partner, whether it's in NATO or to the United States bilaterally or to its European friends, more noxious to deal with. And as it is with Russia, here too, the kind of the ballast that the United States historically provided to that relationship, to the Turkey-Europe relationship, that's kind of gone away. EU accession got started because of decisions that European leaders decisions they made on their own. But the United States was a big advocate, a very big advocate, throughout the 1990s and in the 2000s, George Bush eventually earning some pretty hearty complaints from European leaders that lay off, don't stop pushing us so much all the time. The United States no longer playing that role because of the broader international stance of the Trump administration. But, oh, by the way, U.S.-Turkish relations had already kind of come a cropper over Syria and matters related to it, and in particular the U.S. military's alliance with the anti-Turkish Syrian Kurds in Turkey as the fighting force to go after ISIS. Turkey remains real important to the United States and arguably even more important for Europe because they're neighbors. The strategy that Europe was on to try to affect and influence events, it's over. Same thing the other way around. Turkey's strategy for finding a framework in which to deal with Europe, bankrupt. I want to touch briefly on the Middle East and North Africa, not a place where I have quite the same personal knowledge or experience. Suffice it to say, and this came up in the earlier discussion as well, Europe has been deeply affected by developments over the last 15 years, and especially the last several, by negative developments in that part of the world. We talked earlier about the River of Humanity in 2014, terrorist threats emanating or originating out of that part of the world. Economic, other tensions that exist, beginning for many years here too, beginning in the 1990s, the European Union engaged in association agreement and aid diplomacy as a way to strengthen governance, to strengthen the economies, to strengthen the texture of societies in these countries, to help them deal with their problems, countries right on Europe's doorstep. A similar agenda, stabilize. Advocate of economic reforms, political liberalization, creating more stable societies that would be less likely to export their problems either by overt action or just the way life works to Europe. And fast forward to the Arab Awakening, to the events that happened in Tunisia and Libya, Syria. And here, too, you've got all of a sudden a strategy that Europe was on for a number of years that hadn't worked out very well, to say the least. In different ways, Russia, Turkey, and the Middle East and North Africa, and Europe's ambitions with them, and to some extent how Europe sees itself in the world, have changed quite significantly in ways that I think few really would have anticipated happening 10 or 15 years ago. Driven by these internal developments in Europe, the rise of populism, fracturing, and so on and so forth, and by, politics happens in other countries, as referred to earlier, and by events, trends, and developments elsewhere, America's retreat as a shaper of transatlantic engagement in the world, and especially with regard to Turkey and the Middle East, no longer there in quite the same way. Let me close, how am I doing time-wise? I'm okay. Let me close with five thoughts. There are, I think, very good reasons to be, if not deeply pessimistic, at least very concerned about the fate of Europe and of the West and of Western interests and values because of some of the kinds of things we've talked about here. Europe's got a couple thousand years of history. There's been a lot of ups and downs. The wheel of politics, the wheel of history turns round and round. My guess is a conference like this in 10 or 15 years are going to be talking about a whole bunch of different things, and maybe not just the rise of China, which seems to come up somewhat more than it probably will be seen to have deserved in a couple of decades. If change over the last 10 to 15 years captures our imagination, some imagination about the future, I think, will be essential for the leaders, for those who do statecraft in Europe and in the United States to put together some other ways of affecting these complicated regions that I've referred to and other problems in the world where we have interest, while at the same time finding ways to respond, not through homeopathic medicine, I like that analogy, but finding real ways to respond to the issues that give rise to the populism and the fracturing that takes place. America's interest in a strong, united, peaceful, prosperous, progressive Europe is just as great as it was in the 1940s when we began Marshall Aid Program to Europe, when we built NATO, when we expanded NATO, when we and European leaders expanded both NATO and the European Union further to the east, all of that, there were real good reasons for that. And the policy succeeded by and large, notwithstanding some of the difficulties we've talked about here. Wise statecraft will find ways to keep, not to stay on that same wicket, not to just keep riding the bicycle in that exact same direction, but to preserve those additives to world order and to the security and prosperity of our peoples that our past achievements have done so much to help bring about. To state this another way, democratic values need to succeed. Democracy needs to deliver, and Democrats need to deliver results for their voters, or they're not going to be around. And the whole fabric of our society could ultimately come into question. This organization and organizations like it that promote an honest, direct conversation about developments in the world, a real examination of the facts, not through tweets, but through reading and study and listening to knowledgeable people here. This is extremely important. I want to congratulate Global Minnesota for doing this. I want to thank our panelists for being here today, and thank all of you for being part of this discussion. And I think with that, I'm supposed to close and take some of your questions. Erdogan's goals, this is one of the things that's really hard to see in. Before I went to Turkey in 2005, I met with one of my predecessors who had known Erdogan fairly well when he was mayor of Istanbul. And in fact, when Erdogan was jailed for having read in a public setting, read an Islamist poem that seemed to call into question secularism or his commitment to secular values. Actually, this friend of mine, his ambassador, went and visited him in jail as a demonstration of America's support for democracy and for freedom of speech in Turkey. Anyway, so I asked him, what do you think Erdogan wants? And he said, beats the hell out of me. And he said, I don't think you're going to find out the answer to that. If you barged into his bedroom at 3 o'clock in the morning and caught him unawares, you'd get an answer. But you might not want to put a lot of stock in that either. The best answer I can come up with for what Erdogan wants is power and political success for himself and for his movement and for his role in shaping the future of Turkey. It's not so much about religion. He has talked about an Islamist leader, and clearly he is a pious Muslim, and he has absolutely used religious symbols to advance his political aims. But the aims are power, influence, and dominance. A laser-like focus on political success. I don't think you'll find another leader in Europe. Maybe my European colleagues know of some. I don't think you'd find another political leader in Europe who has so consistently won election after election after election. And except for the referendum that took place in April on reforming or changing the Constitution to empower the presidency, essentially no accusations, no credible case even made by the opposition that hanky-panky was involved. They were free. They may not have been real fair in terms of opposition access to the media and so forth, but they were absolutely free elections and the results, the tabulation of the results, unquestionably reflected the popular will and the majorities that Erdogan or the majorities in parliament that Erdogan and his party have successfully obtained. It's not to say that I'm not endorsing him, but a tremendous record of success and laser-like attention to detail and to succeeding. The problems that arise now, as Erdogan's circle has grown progressively more narrower, and the people that came with him to establish the AK Party in the late 1990s, early 2000s, they're all gone. The people who were kind of his equals, even when I served in Turkey in the late 2000s, they're kind of gone. The people around him are yes men. They're not very creative or inventive. I went back in 2014 to serve as American chargé, and I was struck at that time by the extent to which in every conversation I had with government leaders, and I'd ask about government policy, the first answer and really the only answer I got was, well, that's up to Erdogan. He didn't have anything to say, or had little to say. Quite a big change from what I had seen earlier, where people like Abdullah Gül, Ali Babacan, Bülent Arınç, others, these are names probably for you, but other big heavy hitters in Turkey, they had something to say. And they would add, it's up to Erdogan to decide. But Erdogan deciding wasn't the beginning and the end of it. And that's a severe weakness in any country that is as diverse and still as democratic as a society as Turkey is.
And the same question for Russia. So what do you see as Putin's objectives and goals? And then what does a post-Putin Russia look like?
Oh, I didn't ask what's a post-Erdogan, and I should. In 2007, the Turkish prosecutors brought forth a case to close the AK Party and ban a whole bunch of its leaders, including Erdogan, from politics for 10 or 15 years. We did an analysis at that time of what would be the effect of this. And the effect was that the AK Party still would have enough members of parliament to form a single government all by itself. But it wouldn't last. The glue that holds it together was then, and I think still is today, Tayyip Erdogan. I don't think the AK Party lasts for long. I think then that future is more likely to be the fracturing of the Turkish political environment, maybe not quite the same as Europe's, but of its own kind, a reversion to coalition governments that dominated Turkey in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s that were failures. By and large, failures on economic policy, failures in a variety of other realms, and in any case, weak and unstable. And I think that's the most likely future. Putin, my view is that Putin's main agenda item has been restoring Russia to a great and prominent role in Europe and in the world. Very much a product of what he inherited out of the Yeltsin decade in the 1990s, a Russia that kind of became a laughingstock in Europe. He, at least, became a laughingstock, a Russia that was weak and largely ignored in European settings. Yes, Russia was there because it sort of had to be and it has a seat in the UN Security Council and so forth, but nobody really took it very seriously. And Putin determined to turn that around. Not necessarily recreate the Soviet Union, because he doesn't want those problems back, but the problems of subjugating all of those people around him, especially after what's happened over the last 20 years. But he wants to dominate that space and restore Russians' pride in their government. That's, of course, also good for him politically. But I, unlike Erdogan, I think Putin's focus is very much more on Russia, Russia, Russia. Sees himself as the savior, but Russia is the goal. What comes after Putin? If I had to guess, it'll be somebody like Vladimir Putin, another figure like him out of some combination of the security service writ very large. Who understands politics, and there is politics in Russia, absolutely, but understands power and how to use it.
And then a question here just about kind of the doers in the bureaucracy and your experience working in the Foreign Service. Who are the people that are doing the work on the ground level, not the heads of state, but who are people like you? And I guess to add to that for the students in the room, how does one kind of enter into this field and end up working as an ambassador or in an embassy abroad?
I was talking during the break with a Foreign Service colleague here who told me about a story I'd missed. President Trump asked somewhere about, you know, all of these vacancies at the State Department, and he said, "We don't need any of those people. I'm here." International affairs is serious stuff. You're dealing with a lot of actors, each of which has. Each country has its own politics, its own dynamics, its own way of looking at things, its own ways to be influenced. Complicated issues where the choices you make here have implications for the choice over there, either this geography or that geography, because there's only 24 hours in a work day and you can only do so many things, or this priority versus that priority. I thought I thought it was amazing that at a time the United States is going tongue and hammer with North Korea over the nuclear issue, President Trump decides it's a good time to try to tear down the U.S.-South Korea Free Trade Agreement. It's like, does the right hand know what the left foot is doing? I don't get that. To make foreign policy work successfully is not just about sending a ship someplace, say to the waters off North Korea, or making a public statement or a speech. I thought one of the faults I would attribute to President Obama's foreign policy was a kind of overemphasis on speechifying and not on doing. It's definitely not tweets. It's complicated stuff that involves a lot of different players and actions and levels, and you need people to fill in those details to help you flesh out the what it is that you're trying to do, and then work those pieces with lots of different governments. That's the role the United States has played in the world for the last 70 years. It seems not to be a role that that Trump wants, but Trump wants effects. He wants to accomplish things, and you don't do it just by making speeches. The vacancy level at the State Department continues, I think, seriously to hobble the Trump administration foreign policy, and especially to hobble Secretary Tillerson, who has less experience in matters of international diplomacy or even public policy than any Secretary of State in at least 150 years. He needs help, and he doesn't have it. It's an extremely serious situation, and as it continues, the Obama administration by November 2009 probably only had maybe two-thirds of its people, its new people in place. These things do take time. But as we head into 2018, this just looks catastrophic. For young people, you know, I used to promote the Foreign Service, and in a sense I still do. Hiring now is so low because of decisions that Secretary Trump has made, that the prospects for someone who isn't a veteran and therefore has veterans points or isn't getting in, isn't part of a State Department recruitment program, there are various of these, the prospects for someone that isn't one of those, they maybe hire a dozen individuals a year that fit in those non-earmarked categories. Having said that to the high school folks, my wife and I had an absolutely fantastic career in the Foreign Service. Every single job I had, I can point back to things that made a difference in the world and for America. That's a cool thing.
Okay. We'll do one last question. It's a lightning round question. In your judgment, will Turkey join the EU? And if not, what's going to keep it from doing so?
You know, I would like to be able to say that I think Turkey will become an EU member. Certainly when I served there, the way I articulate it is that I don't think it's imminent. There are generational changes that need to take place in European attitudes toward Turkey, and even bigger attitudinal changes that need to take place in Turkey about themselves, about their past, about who they are and what their role is in the world, about how they relate to their neighbors. And on neither of those fronts has there been any significant progress in the 7 or 8 years since I left Turkey. If anything, it's moved quite dramatically in the other direction. And then on process grounds, it's basically, it's all but dead now. I think the likely scenario is that something will happen in the next 6 to 18 months that will lead to a formal decision to call it off. I think that'll be unfortunate because even as it is now, that magnet of Europe and that appeals to Turks, it's one of the few forces in Turkey that effectively pulls it in a Western direction and in the direction of Western liberal and democratic values. And I just hate to see that go away. A decision to call it to a halt it theoretically doesn't mean that it can't come back on the agenda at some point in the future. But it was extremely hard to make it happen in 2004. My European colleagues know that better than I do. It would be even harder to make it happen again. I think that will be European and American leaders will look back on the failure of this process, which owes, as I tried to say, to a ton of things that Turkey did too, but look back on the failure of this process as a big miscalculation and something that we will regret.
Ambassador Wilson, thank you very much. One last round of applause.
Thank you.